Good evening. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host, along with Ray Schwab. Ray, good evening to you.
How you doing, John?
We have a very interesting topic to consider tonight, and we have three guests who are going to help us explore meeting the challenges of mental illness and suicide prevention in the Lehigh Valley. First, I want to give just the briefest background of mental illness in our country. First of all, I found that we go way back. Now, this is over in ancient Greece. In the 5th century BCE, Hippocrates was a pioneer in treating mentally ill people with techniques not rooted in religion or superstition. Instead, he focused on changing a mentally ill patient's environment or occupation, or administering certain substances as medications. I didn't know it went back that far. Now, let's skip ahead to the United States. How about the 1840s? Activist Dorothea Dix lobbied for better living conditions for the mentally ill after witnessing the dangerous and unhealthy conditions in which many patients lived. And so eventually there were 32 state psychiatric hospitals by the 1880s. Now, push ahead about a century to the 1950s, a push for deinstitutionalization and outpatient treatment began in many countries, facilitated by the development of a variety of antipsychotic drugs. By the 1960s in the U.S., many severely mentally ill people had been moved from psychiatric institutions to local mental health homes or similar facilities. In place of institutionalized care, community-based mental health care was developed. And now we go back to a little bit in time to 1909, when Mental Health America, MHA, was founded by Clifford Beers as the National Committee for Mental Hygiene, worked to improve the lives of people with mental illnesses in the U.S. In 1946, President Harry Truman passed the National Mental Health Act, creating the National Institute of Mental Health and allocated government funds toward research. In 1963, Congress passed the Mental Retardation Facilities and Community Health Centers Construction Act. That's a long title. And we get now to the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which was founded in 1979, better known as, to those who are interested in the area, as NAMI, N-A-M-I, to provide support, education, advocacy, and research services for people with serious psychiatric illnesses. With that background, let me introduce our three guests today. Dr. Peter Langman is president of the Lehigh Valley chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, or AFSP. He is a psychologist in private practice in Allentown and author of Why Kids Kill: Inside the Minds of School Shooters. He maintains the website schoolshooters.info, the largest collection of materials relating to school shooters that exists online. Congratulations, Peter, on that.
Thank you very much.
He serves on the Pennsylvania Joint State Government Advisory Committee on Violence Prevention. So, welcome to Dr. Peter Langman. Dr. Lawrence Carper has been a NAMI Lehigh Valley board member since 2010. Dr. Carper is a board-certified psychiatrist specializing in the treatment of individuals with medication refractory illness. Larry, what is medication refractory illness?
In psychiatry and mental illness, it is not unusual for people not to respond or to respond minimally to standard treatment, and that's where I've been focusing on.
He received his MD from UMDNJ, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and is the vice chair of inpatient psychiatric services in Lehigh Valley Health Network. So welcome to Larry.
Thank you.
And we have Diane Gilroy. She is president of the Lehigh Valley chapter of the National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI. She has a master's degree in secondary education, is a co-leader of the Allentown NAMI support group, and co-chair of the NAMI Lehigh Valley 5K Run Walk. So today we have a very interesting panel of a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and a family member. And yours truly is also a family member. So this is very near and dear to my heart. Diane, let's start off by talking a little bit about NAMI and NAMI Lehigh Valley. What can we say about this organization? What does it do?
This organization was founded in 1983 by families in the Lehigh Valley, and What we do is try to help persons who have mental illness as well as helping their families. Our board consists of people with mental illness who are in recovery, family members, and also professionals. And our goal is to help families and persons with mental illness understand mental illness.
Our vocabulary changes as we go along, too. We're no longer talking about the mentally ill, but I noticed that you said people who have
exactly.
a mental illness. And what's the difference in those two terms, Peter?
Well, there's a difference in implication, and what the terminology is trying to do is to recognize that they're people first. They're not just beings who are mentally ill, whatever that may mean, but they're human beings with full lives and people in their lives and talents and strengths and so on who happen to have a mental illness the same way someone could have a physical illness. So the terminology is important.
I like the expression people first or person first. Larry, what are the serious mental illnesses that we're talking about here?
Well, the persistent and chronic mental illnesses usually fall into the predominantly psychotic disorders and the predominantly mood disorders. The psychotic disorders have as their presenting or key quality psychosis, which is also to be understood as a difference or gap in the person's ability to understand reality as other people see it. Some people misconstrue the term psychosis as being violent or intensely agitated, although those things are rarely associated with people in crisis situations. It refers to difficulty in grasping reality, and symptoms such as delusions, fixed false beliefs, hallucinations, and confused thinking. And the diagnoses that fall into that category are schizoaffective disorder and schizophrenia and some of the more severe forms of bipolar disorder, which is also mood disorder. The predominant mood disorders, major depression and bipolar disorder.
So these are the illnesses with which NAMI is involved. And both from the patient standpoint and also from family members' standpoint, because we're trying to get the family members to know what they should expect and how to deal with the person who is having some psychotic break or who is having problems.
The way that we help families is that we offer an education course. It's 12 weeks long, 3 hours an evening. In those 12 weeks, and in that course, two family members who are also affected with a family member who has mental illness are the instructors, and they've been trained in this course, and they will help the persons in the course to understand the different types of symptoms that might appear, the ways to talk with their person, loved person who has mental illness, ways to understand about the medications, and other coping skills that are very important. For instance, do you set boundaries? What should those boundaries be? And these things vary from family to family, and in this course you meet other people who are having similar situations, and it's a wonderful discussion place.
And this is a course only for family members, not for patients.
That's correct. Any family member.
As a professional, I've found that families confronting the initial diagnosis or the initial symptoms of a severe illness in psychiatry are often bewildered. They don't really understand it because of the abstract nature of mental illness, that it doesn't present with laboratory tests or obvious physical problems. And so I think a group like NAMI has been so helpful at helping family members understand, have a new way of looking at mental illness, because for most people coming into a new diagnosis, it is confusing. They don't quite know where to turn or how to deal with it. And I think NAMI's been very helpful with that.
One of the immediate reactions is, this is not really happening to me or to our family.
Or what do we do about this? I don't understand this. I've never had to deal with mental illness before.
Now, this course called Family to Family is going to begin. Another session of the 12 weeks is going to begin in September. Let's give the telephone number for people to call for NAMI Lehigh Valley.
It's 610-882-2102. And you can also email us at info@NAMILV.org.
Diane is the president of the local chapter of NAMI, the Lehigh Valley chapter, and Dr. Peter Langman and Dr. Lawrence Carper are members of the board. So you have a strong board going there.
Yes, we do.
What is most understood about mental illness, would you say, out there in society?
What is most understood?
Misunderstood.
Oh, misunderstood. Okay. A lot of people don't even really accept the concept of mental illness. I've had people tell me, you know, I don't really believe in this sort of thing. They think it's just a matter of people being weak, not having sufficient willpower, that if they only made the effort, they could change, they could stop being depressed, they could stop being bipolar, and so on. So I think one of the misunderstood things is that it is not a matter of willpower. It's not something you just can decide to wake up one day and not be mentally ill anymore. So that's one thing I've run into.
Right.
Another misunderstanding, misperception, is the chronicity of treatment. So that if someone has diabetes, everybody understands that unless they have some type of curative event or they lose a lot of weight, depending on the type of diabetes, generally speaking, the treatment for diabetes lasts a very long time, and the expectation is to maintain it, make it stable, and to live the best life you can. Whereas with mental illness, people frequently ask, why are you still seeking treatment? Why are you taking medications? And this is where NAMI and professional organizations help educate people that for some people, not everybody, for some people, it is a lifelong illness or an extended period of time of various kinds of treatment, psychotherapeutic treatments, group therapy, peer support, as well as medications.
Yeah, along those lines, sometimes people will take their medication and then get better, and then think, oh, I'm better now, I don't need my medication, and they go off it, not really understanding that the reason they're doing better is because of the medication, and they need to keep taking it. And sometimes there may be pressure from family members to stop taking the medication, and that can have disastrous consequences.
Peter, isn't that true of other illnesses, too? I'm thinking of strep throat, and you get some penicillin and you're told to take it for 10 days and you take it for 3 days and you feel fine. And you say, well, why should I keep drugging myself for the next 7 days? So you stop and then you could have problems with it.
Exactly.
I think almost everybody, I was in a meeting one time when somebody, the speaker asked the audience, when was the last time, not did you ever do this, but when was the last time that you did not follow through taking all the medicine that you were supposed to? And, of course, a week ago, a month ago. So this is something that not just with mental illness treatments, but with other treatments too. Question, sometimes we talk about physical illnesses and mental illnesses as if they were two different spheres. Is that a false notion, Mary?
Well, I think it's much more complicated and abstract in mental illness. However, we do believe that the majority of mental illnesses have a genetic component, and you might think of that as a vulnerability, so that individuals with particular genetic problems or genetic differences will be much more vulnerable to stress and then much more likely to develop a mental illness. One of the areas that has received a lot of press lately is the effects of marijuana and synthetic marijuana and other drugs on the brain. And although it's clear that many people will be able to try a drug and not have permanent deleterious side effects, although drugs are very dangerous, and as a physician I've seen a lot of damage because of them, it's clear that some individuals are highly vulnerable and develop full-blown psychotic states or mood disorders from the use of even a small amount of, for example, marijuana. So some people do have these genetic, we think, vulnerabilities. We can't define them all, but we know they tend to run in families, and they appear to confer a much higher likelihood of the developing of a mental illness.
Well, and nowadays, aren't we talking about chemistry in the brain being very central to what's happening to cause mental illnesses? To me, that seems physical.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the monoamines in the brain, things like most people have heard of serotonin, but less commonly understood is dopamine, norepinephrine, other chemicals like excitatory amino acids, these certainly appear to be either abnormal or medications do alter the transmission of the neurons in the brain affected by these neurochemicals. And these seem to have dramatic beneficial effects for many people. I still think, at an early stage of understanding the ultimate use of medications and psychoactive drugs in the brain. In addition, emotions and life events can change the chemical and neurological structure of the brain. So I like to think of these as a double kind of arrow, that A leads to B and B leads to A, so that the emotions can change the brain, changes in the brain can affect emotions and behavior.
And you do have brain scans where you can put one in opposition to the other, a so-called normal brain and then a brain that has been affected in some way by the chemical imbalance. That puts it, again, on a physical
level. Absolutely. There's been a tremendous amount of studies, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder, affecting particular regions of the brain like the hippocampus and other areas.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're chatting this evening with Dr. Peter Langman, a psychologist, Diane Gilroy, family member, and Dr. Lawrence Carper, psychiatrist. And we're talking about meeting the challenges of mental illness and suicide prevention in the Lehigh Valley. It's time for us to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this topic of suicide.
You're listening to WDIY, Community Public Radio for the Lehigh Valley. If you appreciate and value the programming we provide, including NPR's in-depth news coverage, our local public affairs programs, and the diverse mix of music we broadcast each day, please consider becoming a member. Membership is our most important source of revenue. We can't do it without you. You can make a secure donation online at wdiy.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Back to talk about. We're back talking about the challenges of mental illness and suicide prevention in the Lehigh Valley. I want to turn to Dr. Lawrence Carper and ask what kinds of things cause people to take their own lives?
There isn't one answer to that question. It's a complex question because of human behavior. One approach is called predicament and adamance. And I think this is a kind of a helpful model or way of looking at the difficulties that people go through, that usually there's a predicament or problem that faces a person, and that can be in their social life, which is not unusual. Usually it involves some shameful event or some event that affects a person's way of looking at themselves. For some people, it might be a loss of job, a loss of a relationship, or some event that causes them to feel alone, different, alienated from other people. And then they have an adamant or narrow way of looking at the answers, and they come up with one plan, which may be to harm themselves, as opposed to all the different options, coping, seeking out help from others. We try to help people look at other options. The biology probably involves depression and mood, and that when people are depressed, they tend to have a narrower or pessimistic view. The same situation to a non-depressed person might cause them to feel ready to take on a challenge, whereas a depressed person who may see the glass half empty may see it as hopelessness. And hopelessness seems to be the key mental driver. There's a biological component, but a clear psychological, sociological, if you will, component to why people might make that choice.
Is a person who we might consider to be a loner more likely to fall into the area of contemplating suicide than a person who's gregarious and likes to be with people?
I would say there is reason to think that people without significant social supports are at greater risk for suicide. So that if someone is well connected with friends, has a close loving family, realizes he has a close loving family, and so on, those are protective factors. So even if someone is depressed, he or she may be less likely to think about taking their own lives. So I think that social connectedness piece is important.
The other side of that, and I totally agree with what Peter said, the other side of it is that people who have a lot of their self-image bound up with how other people see them, if they have a situation where there is a break in that, where they have a well-publicized failure, or they don't live up to their own way that they want to be, high perfectionism, high achieving, a fall from that level can also trigger it. However, their sense of connectedness to other people still runs into that in terms of helping them. However, one shouldn't think that because someone has a lot of friends that then necessarily they're not going to harm themselves, that frequently people harm themselves or commit suicide and it comes as a shock to friends and family.
Right. I also am disturbed, or I'm concerned about the use of the word friends. You know, young people will say, I want to be with all my friends. Well, if you have one or two real friend or friends, to me that's a lot in life. The others are acquaintances. And so we get caught into this person being surrounded by all these people, but most of the people really are not deep relationship with the person. What are some of the warning signs that you could look for somebody who might be contemplating suicide?
Well, there's some basic things that indicate the possible presence of severe depression, which is often linked with suicidal thoughts. So if people stop functioning the way they normally function, for young people, that would be their grades suddenly plummet. They stop playing sports that they used to play. They stop doing the activities that were important to them. That could be a sign of depression. Not necessarily a warning sign that they're at risk for suicide, but that there's something going on. Similarly, for adults, if they lose the ability to function, they just can't get up out of bed anymore, and they're just struggling to get through the day. Those would be warning signs of depression. Specific warning signs about suicide could be comments they make. You know, I don't know why I even bother anymore. You know, sometimes I just think the world would be better off without me. You know, I wish I had never been born. Or they may actively talk about, you know, wanting to kill themselves if I only had a gun. And they may brush that off as joking, but if you really probed with them, they would say, yes, I am thinking about taking my own life.
So if I hear someone say, it could be a family member of mine or it could be someone I know, even casually, and hear one of these sentences come out from the person, what should I do?
I think it's important to just ask them, do they really mean it? There's often a fear that asking someone if he's having suicidal thoughts is going to plant the idea in his head. So if he weren't having suicidal thoughts, now he will be. And that's just not the case. If a person's not suicidal, mentioning the topic is not going to make them suicidal. So you can ask them, you know, say, I'm really concerned about what you just said. Are you having thoughts about killing yourself? And having that conversation, and they may be glad someone is opening up the door to that topic so that now they can talk. And maybe the person didn't feel comfortable calling a professional for help, but maybe a friend or family member could help them make that call or make the call for them, just to initiate the process of getting connected with someone who could help them.
What are some of the local resources that we have for people who are struggling with depression and hopelessness?
Well, there's a whole range of sources. Depends on the person's situation, whether or not they have health insurance, what kind of insurance, and so on. But there's a range of professionals, whether it's social workers, licensed professional counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, who are trained to help people struggling with depression and other mental health issues. And there's a lot of people in private practice who are available. There's various organizations or hospitals if people need inpatient treatment, if they're really in crisis, on the verge of possibly taking their own lives, then outpatient would not be sufficient. So you want to get them inpatient treatment. There's also places like Lehigh County Crisis Unit, so they can come out and evaluate people to see if they need inpatient treatment or not.
And how would a person get in touch with the crisis line if someone really wants to talk to a professional about a particular problem?
You can just look up Lehigh County Crisis online on the Lehigh County website, list all the human services they provide and the numbers available there. Other counties have similar crisis units.
I've found that the number 911 has served a great purpose, because when people are in trouble, they tend to just, it's a short number that we all remember. If a person calls 911, is that good advice or not for this?
That can be a life-saving measure. If you don't know the county crisis number, you don't even know there is such a thing, you can at least call 911 and get immediate response.
Because 911 acts as a referral service in many cases?
Yeah, absolutely. And depending on the urgency, one very easy thing to remember is to take it seriously, so that any discussion about it, if the person is talking about it, to take it seriously and to go to the nearest emergency room, and you can get an evaluation there. That's obviously, just like any other medical problem, if it's that severe, that you can always go there 24/7 get an emergency evaluation to see what's next. Some people will need to go into a hospital. Some people might have a medical problem that's causing them to feel anxious or depressed, and some people might have drug addiction issues. And so in all the area emergency departments, they are able to do a full evaluation, come up with a plan that might include inpatient or outpatient treatment or referral.
And another important question, how can we support a family member who has had somebody in the family take his own life?
The loss of someone to suicide is just a devastating loss. You know, any loss of a loved one can be hard, but suicide carries such a stigma that there's an extra burden to it. There is a local support group run by the organization Family Answers in Allentown, and they meet every couple of weeks, and it's a group specifically for people who have lost a loved one to suicide. Also, the board of the local chapter of AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, has several members who are suicide survivors, meaning they have lost someone to suicide, and they're willing to do outreach and talk to people just to help them through, to talk about their own experiences.
You are very active in that organization, AFSP, Peter. What does the local chapter do?
We try to do a lot around just making people aware of suicide as a health issue, raising awareness about the warning signs, about the local resources, and also raising money to support research and prevention efforts. So one of our big events of the year is coming up October 6th, and that's the Out of the Darkness Walk. And you can go to outofthedarkness.org and find walks near you. The local one is in Allentown, and you can register online. And last year, we had several hundred people walk. We raised approximately $25,000.
Wow. Where is the walk located?
The walk is in the Lehigh Parkway. And the money that we raise goes partly to the national organization to support research and prevention, and partly it stays locally to support our own efforts about public awareness and prevention.
So it's a national organization, and we have a local chapter here in the Lehigh Valley.
That is right.
Mm-hmm. So October 6th is the date for that, and what time?
Registration starts at 11. The walk starts at noon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nice, decent hour. And a beautiful place to take a walk.
Yes.
Lehigh Parkway. Thank you, Peter. Let's talk a little bit about other programs that we have from NAMI, Diane. We mentioned Family to Family, which is a 12-week educational program. We also have support groups, and you're very active in that area.
Yes, we do. We have support groups in Bethlehem, Allentown, and Easton for family members. We also have support groups that are for persons who have mental illness. So when you go onto our website, you can see the different times and places that we meet. A lot of the meetings happen to take place at our office on 802 West Broad Street in Bethlehem.
Right. And if a person goes online to look up something, if you put in just NAMI Lehigh Valley, N-A-M-I, Lehigh Valley, you'll get information
sure.
that you need.
Sure, that will come up.
Right. These support groups are different from the education pieces. The support groups go on forever.
And yes.
They meet generally?
They meet generally once a month. You could go to one in Allentown one week and go to another one in Bethlehem the next week if you'd like to. Now, for persons who have mental illness, we actually have a support group that meets once a week in our office, and that's on Thursdays from 5:30 to 7.
And that's at the NAMI office, 802 West Broad Street.
Yes, 802 West Broad in Bethlehem. And we also have courses for persons who have mental illness. We have a course that's called Peer to Peer. That group meets for 10 weeks, but it's only a couple of hours a week on the same day. And that course begins in October.
October 3rd.
October 3rd is the next date for that course to begin. Generally, with our courses, we have a spring course and then a fall course. If we have enough people interested, we'll add another course during the year.
And this is for people who are battling mental illnesses. And the course is taught by people who have a mental illness.
That's correct.
So these education pieces tend to be, really, all of them are peer-to-peer. If it's family-to-family, it's a family member, two family members who are in the same boat as the people who are taking the course.
Correct.
And they are teaching how to cope with the situation that's come up in their family.
That's right.
And the peer-to-peer is two people with mental illnesses teaching others with mental illnesses
how to cope. Yes. Right. And we also offer a course which is for parents or caretakers of children and adolescents who have mental illness. That course actually has been added the last couple years, and we've had good success with this, a lot of people interested. It is a six-week course that's 2.5 hours a week, or if depending on the persons who have signed up for it, if it's more convenient for them to meet three Saturdays for a longer time, say with lunch in the middle, we will make arrangements to do that so that these people can attend the course and get the value that they can from that.
Yeah, just to follow up on the issue of children and adolescents with mental health issues, people should be aware that the organization Kids Peace offers a variety of services locally for children and adolescents, whether it's outpatient counseling, in-home services, foster care, a psychiatric hospital for kids in crisis, residential treatment, and so on. So if you have a child or adolescent who's suicidal or has significant mental health issues, that's another local resource. Also, for the adolescents themselves, Kids Peace has a website called teencentral.net. And that has saved the lives of many kids, because a lot of kids are not going to tell their parents that they're having suicidal thoughts, but they will go online anonymously and write to a professional counselor about what's going on, get advice, maybe seek help based on that advice, or just learn enough in the way of coping skills that they get through the crisis. So teencentral.net is a site that kids should be using and parents should feel good about their kids using. It's not a chat room. They're not communicating with other kids. They only communicate with professional counseling staff.
And again, I want to reiterate what Peter said a couple of minutes ago, that to talk to someone who you suspect might be thinking in terms of suicide for himself, to mention that is not putting the idea into the person's head. If the person had the idea before you came along, and you're showing interest, and you're showing that you care. Diane, there's another program with NAMI called In Our Own Voice, in which two people, are we no longer saying consumers? Let's get our vocabulary straight here. This is a difficult thing to get our brains around, because we've been saying consumers for a long time, people who consume psychiatric drugs and psychiatric services and psychological services. And now there are many consumers who reject the notion of that moniker. So when we come back from our break, we're going to talk a little bit about who are these people. I used the term patient before in our interview. Let's take a few whacks at that and see what we come up with. When we come back, we are speaking this evening with Dr. Peter Langman, Dr. Lawrence Carper, and Diane Gilroy on the important topic of the challenges of mental illness and suicide prevention.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Is your car so environmentally incorrect that it creates its own ecosystem?
Donate it through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
This station gets the proceeds and you get a tax break.
To find out more, call 866-789-8627.
Car Talk airs Friday night at 6 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. For more information, visit our website at wdiy.org.
We're back with our guests talking about mental illness and suicide prevention. Diane, you wanted to mention something about the programs that are offered by NAMI.
I want to make it very clear that our programs are free, so that you don't need to worry about whether you have money in the bank or in your pocket to take advantage of these programs.
This is one place where we never ask about insurance.
No, we don't. No, we don't.
It's an excellent array of opportunities for people who simply want to get more very good information about mental illnesses and mental health to go to NAMI, N-A-M-I, here in the Lehigh Valley. Peter, International?
International Survivors of Suicide Day. This is another event that's coming up this fall that I think people should be aware of. In terms of supporting people who have lost a loved one to suicide, this day, International Survivors of Suicide Day, is a very profound and moving experience. And on that day, people all over the world go to a location and watch a broadcast of a panel discussion involving people who have lost loved ones to suicide. And they talk about their recovery, talk about how the event hit them, who the person was. Was it a parent, a sibling, a child, a spouse? And the panel represents all those different types of suicide loss, and they talk about their journeys. And at each local site, such as the one we do in the Lehigh Valley, there's people there, and they come together, and they realize that they're not alone, and it's a public place to get support and to talk about something that people really don't know where else to talk about it. You know, how do you talk about losing a loved one to suicide? So it's a place to get public support, to start the conversation, to see how other people have coped with their loss, and to give people hope.
Where does this take place?
It's at the Muhlenberg campus of Lehigh Valley Health Network. It'll be November 23rd. It's always the Saturday before Thanksgiving. So this year it's November 23rd. You can go to afsp.org for more information, or you know, just do a search for International Survivors of Suicide Day.
Very interesting. Let's talk more generally now about prevention of suicide, Larry.
Well, you can think about prevention of suicide as any other major health problem, and I think people tend to overlook suicide as a public health issue. So it is one of the top causes of illness and death in young people, and it is a major public health problem. And if you look at it from the broadest sense, I think what we're doing here tonight is critical in terms of the picture of reducing suicide by improving public understanding, knowledge, and reducing stigma. You can also look at it from the individual's point of view, treatment of psychiatric illness, vigorously helping people feel better, be more accepted, be more functional. And that's critical at the level of the individual. Somewhere between the big picture of all of society and the individual is identifying people at risk for mental illness and getting them into treatment. So that's the kind of big picture. In terms of research, there's a tremendous amount of research on the national level in understanding the neurobiology of depression and other mental illnesses and coming up with better treatment. But I think if you look at what we're doing here, what people can do today is to work on a better understanding of mental illness and reducing stigma throughout the United States.
Very well stated. The matter of, I'm interested in this International Survivors of Suicide Day because it's family members, just the way we talk about family members in NAMI, of a person who has a mental illness. Now this is a person who had a mental illness. Can we say that people who take their own lives were definitely had some sort of a mental problem?
Research indicates that the vast majority of people who take their own lives had a diagnosable disorder, most often a form of depression, could be schizophrenia. People with schizophrenia have a very high suicide rate. It could be other disorders, but in most cases, there's something that could have been diagnosed even if it had not been diagnosed during their lifetime.
So let's talk a little bit more about the AFSP, the Association for Suicide.
American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Thank you. Who are the people on the board here in the Lehigh Valley?
Locally, we have a mix of mental health professionals, people in local government agencies, and as I said earlier, several people who have lost a loved one to suicide. So we have someone representing Lehigh County Mental Health Services. We have someone representing the City of Allentown and the Allentown Health Bureau. And we have, you know, people who have lost children to suicide, a spouse to suicide, and so on. So it's that blend of professionals and family members so that we kind of get the best of both perspectives. So we have the science background, the research background, but also the human element. What is it really like?
Very important. Does Northampton County come into this group?
The local chapter is really the greater Lehigh Valley chapter. So it's Lehigh County, Northampton County, surrounding areas, because there's not another chapter for some distance. So it's really the greater Lehigh Valley chapter.
That's the same as NAMI. We always have the two counties principally that we're
basically
dealing with,
yes.
Lehigh and Northampton. And it's to me, it's a big plus to have the two counties working together, because lots of times you would have very similar organizations in both counties sort of duplicating efforts. Is Is losing someone to suicide different from other losses?
I think it is, because there's an element of guilt, of not recognizing it, thinking I should have seen it coming, I should have done something. People tend to play over the day and the weeks prior to the suicide repeatedly for years, just thinking, what did I miss? Could I have done something? So there's an element of guilt and a sense of responsibility with it that is not necessarily true of other types of loss. Also, it's just harder to talk about because of the stigma associated with suicide and mental illness. You know, if you lose someone to cancer, it's different than losing someone to suicide. And it's just harder to have a public conversation about that type of loss. So I think it's much harder for families to deal with a suicide loss.
One of the things I think that's good about the way things are progressing is just our ability to have a program like this interview, to have organizations that are out there talking about the dreaded mental illnesses. We can remember, those of us who are old enough, can remember when cancer was the C word, and you didn't want to admit that somebody in your family had cancer. Now it's, what kind of cancer are we talking about? You know, and it's, I think, because it's in it's in conversation much more than it used to be. It's out in the open, and I think that can only help. So I thank you all for coming to share your wisdom about these different mental illnesses. Diane, what else do we have on the docket?
Well, I want to make sure that our listeners know that this Saturday, August 31st, at Lehigh Parkway, there will be a 5K run and walk in memory of Vivek Anthanen. The run begins at 9 o'clock. The walk begins at 10 o'clock. There's a $30 registration fee for the run, and those who register will receive a T-shirt. If a walker donates $15, that walker will receive a T-shirt as well. And you can go to the NAMI website to learn more about the run walk in memory of Vivek Anthanen. Our website is NAMI-Lehigh Valley.org. It is NAMI-LV.org. Then we have another run coming up the last Saturday in September. That's September 28th. And that's our annual NAMI 5K run and walk. The run begins at 9 o'clock. The walk begins at 9:15. This will be at Bicentennial Park in East Allen Township.
That's north of the airport.
That's correct.
About 3 miles, I think.
Yes. And you can go to NAMI-LV.org to learn about our run walk. Registration for the run is $25. Or you can call 610-882-2102. And proceeds of both run walks will go to our local NAMI.
Thank you. I see that for the annual run walk on September 28th, there are food, raffles, live music. There might even be a clown who shows up. Who knows? It's a fun morning. Registration at from 8 to 8:45, and then 9 o'clock the run starts, 9:15 the walk starts. And I think if we were honest about it, we would say run/walk/sit, because I've seen people just go and just enjoy the people watching and a beautiful day if we get lucky.
And I think we could say run/walk/party, because we have food, we have things for your kids to do, you can bring your dog along. It's a great time.
It really is, and look forward to it every year. When back on the topic of suicide, and particularly family members who have survived a suicide in the family, Dr. Carper and Dr. Langman, do you see family members in this category in your practices?
Sometimes I do, yes.
Is it more common for you to see, now this is in a psychological practice, is it more common for you to see someone who is contemplating suicide before that actually happens, or that you see the family members afterwards?
You know, it's hard to say which is more common. I see some of both. And they each present different challenges in terms of helping people through those crises.
And Dr. Carper, in your practice?
For example, in the hospital, almost everybody that comes to the inpatient unit has severe symptoms like suicidal thinking, so that's very common. And we also evaluate individuals' families, and a history of suicide is not uncommon in people that are currently in crisis, and that's something that we evaluate and address as needed.
As a psychiatrist, can you tell quickly in an interview whether the person who says, maybe I want to end my life, is serious about that or not?
This is a very difficult thing because prediction is very, very hard. We have an approach to prediction. We categorize people as low risk, medium risk, and high risk. However, psychiatry as a field isn't very good at precisely predicting. So what we do is we are very cautious and we admit people for an evaluation. Not everybody that comes to the ER is admitted, but we have an algorithm in terms of understanding. We go through various risk analyses, and then if they're admitted to the hospital, we take more time, involve family, try to get as much information so that generally it can take, in an inpatient setting, up to 72 hours to do our initial plan and then connect people to an outpatient program so they have ongoing follow-up. So it's not easy at one particular point in time to predict what the future will be, but we believe that we know what people need, which is a connection to treatment, understanding themselves and with their family, and frequently an initial medication trial. And that medications have been shown to improve certainly depression and other severe symptoms that then help people feel better and engage in the work of getting better.
And you say that psychiatry is not very good at predicting. Well, so that would take care of a lot of the rest of us too. But psychiatry has the big problem, in my view, of being able to treat a person going through a mental illness because each individual is different from other individuals, not the way a broken arm or some other kind of physical illness might be. Is that correct?
Well, the meaning of the crisis is important. So if someone, breaks their tibia or fibula, I think it's called, generally speaking, it doesn't really matter why. It's let's fix it. Is there metal in the flesh? Do we have to cauterize it or sew it, et cetera? I don't do that type of thing. However, in mental illness and emotional problems, the meaning of a situation is very important. And so it has unique characteristics. And developing that relationship with a person, a trusting, caring relationship, is absolutely critical in the therapeutic situation, much more so than in other areas. And after years and years of research, the best outcomes are related to trust between treaters and individual suffering.
Now, to be a psychiatrist, let's say we might have some listeners who are budding psychiatrists out there. It's a long road of years of study.
But it's like like any specialty within the healthcare field, college, medical school, and then internship and residency. So yes, it is a long. Long road, but well worth it, I think.
Isn't it longer than other MD degrees?
It's a 4-year residency, so some residencies are 3 years. Some of the surgical residencies are a bit longer, but it is kind of a hike to get through.
Right. Well, we're happy that you took that hike.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank our guests now. Diane, do you have something else?
I do. I just have something really quick. This is an outreach that NAMI does for the Lehigh Valley. We have persons who have mental illness, who are in recovery, who take training to learn to be presenters. And what they present is a program called In Our Own Voice. And it's about how they were diagnosed and what their lives are now, how they have found ways to cope and to be happy despite having a mental illness. Another program that we offer is Breaking the Silence. And in that program, we have instructors who go to a school district on the teacher in service day, and they will teach teachers. They will give them actually the materials that they need to teach a class on mental illness so that students in our local schools can learn about mental illness, about how to recognize it, and what they can do to help the people who have it. And in addition to that, our director, when a local group requests, our director will go out and she will speak to the group as well. So those are three different options, in our own voice, breaking the silence, or having our director, Janet, come and speak to your group. So just you can call our number to ask for any of those presentations. And again, like all of our programs, those would be free. The number is 610-882-2102.
And that's NAMI Lehigh Valley. So thank you, Dr. Peter Langman, Dr. Lawrence Carper, and Diane Gilroy for enlightening us today on the challenges of mental illness and suicide prevention in the Lehigh Valley. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that does it for Lehigh Valley Discourse. Ray, remember, as you go about your week, to be gentle
with your neighbor.